This is the second day of this November 2008 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from our text titled Zen Dawn, which is a collection of the early, what are reputed to be the earliest Zen texts rediscovered in the 20th century in the Dunhuang Caves. We left off yesterday reading the words of Bodhidharma's predecessor, Gunabhadra, and we'll continue there. He quotes the Huayan Sutra, "If you have no views, then you can see." And nice pithy way of putting it. Views in Buddhism, really means notions about things, opinions, that are ego based, basically, limited. If you have no views, then you can see. And he quotes another sutra, I've never heard of this, Si Yi Sutra. "It is not something seen with the eyes or known by the senses. It must be seen by according with thusness." That is a coming into harmony with things as they are. And then he quotes another text I've never heard of. "Bats and owls do not see things in daylight, but rather by night. This is due to the inversions of false thinking." How so? "Bats and owls see what to others is darkness as light. Ordinary people see what to others is light as darkness. Both are cases of false thinking." Here he's just taking some liberty to find this kind of symmetry here. Certainly he would know that bats and owls, like all sentient beings, are whole and complete and are themselves embodiments of this true nature. But he's using it as an analogy here. Both are cases of false thinking. Because of their inverted perceptions, because of their karmic barriers, ordinary people do not see reality. This being so, light is not definitely light, and darkness is not definitely darkness. If you understand like this, and you are not confused by inverted thinking, then you will enter into the eternity, the bliss, the personality, and the purity of the Tathagatas. These four words, translated here as eternity, bliss, personality, and purity of the Tathagatas, are the same that we use, we chant in the Kanongyo, eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. And these all refer to the nature of the Buddha, Buddhas, enlightened ones, our own enlightened nature. This is our enlightened nature, in our true nature, may be found this, the eternal, the joyous, the selfless, and the pure. There are a couple of allusions here to inverted perceptions, inverted thinking. We're told that when Shakyamuni came to his great enlightenment, he cried out, "Wonder of wonders! Fundamentally, all beings are Buddha, but because of their inverted thinking, they fail to perceive this." False thinking. Karmic barriers. He goes on, the Lankavatara Sutra says, "How can one purify one's thoughts? Do not allow false thinking. Do not allow defiled thinking. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of Buddha. Let mindfulness of Buddha continue without a break. You will be still, without thoughts, and you will witness the fundamental empty purity." This mindfulness of Buddha. Buddha here is with small b, which we can understand that as our enlightened awareness. Let's plug that in. Do not allow false thinking. Do not allow defiled thinking. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of our enlightened nature. Let mindfulness of our true nature continue without a break. So this means, for people who are working on Mu, let mindfulness of Mu continue without a break. For people who are working on Who or What, same thing. To the degree that we are absorbed, mindful of, in our practice, this is what the translator here renders as mindfulness of Buddha. Let's go back to where he poses the question, how can one purify one's thoughts? Do not allow false thinking. We can understand this to mean don't cling to false thinking. Thoughts arise on their own. Once they're in our mind, they're in our mind. They suddenly are there. But then we can choose not to dwell in these thoughts or cling to them. Same thing with this defiled thinking. Maybe here he means more states of blind passions that arise. This happens even in Sesshin, where one might suddenly be seized with some strong passion or craving or anger. Okay, these things happen, but don't cling to them. We cling to them by thinking about them, by dwelling in the thought of the object of the anger or the craving. I've heard people sometimes laughingly admit to having during Zazen having feasted on some fantasy or another, and this is crazy. Why would you want to do this? Why would you choose once you notice that you have this thought or image in the mind? Why would you want to cling to it? so self-sabotaging. So any of the sense objects sight, sound, touch, smell, taste, so forth. Our job in Zazen is to notice when we've been snagged in these objects of the mind, and then let them go. Go back to the practice. And then this Guna Bahadra quotes the Buddha, "You learn from the teacher, but enlightenment does not come from the teacher. Whoever would make people wise," that has quotation marks around it, "whoever would make people wise has never expounded the Dharma. It is verified in the event." So, no teacher has ever made someone else wise. No teacher has ever given anything to someone else. This is utterly unnecessary. Every person has everything he or she needs. All wisdom, boundless wisdom. It's a matter of uncovering it. And then he again quotes the Buddha, "The leaves of a tree can preach the Dharma. A jar can preach the Dharma. A pillar can preach the Dharma. A staff can preach the Dharma. A room can preach the Dharma. Earth, water, fire, and air can all preach the Dharma. Earth, wood, tile, and stone can also preach the Dharma. What is this?" Zen Master Zhao Zhou, Joshu, was once asked, "What is the teaching of the Dharma in the distant mountains where no one is present?" And Zhao Zhou said, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." There's thusness again, or suchness. There's a phrase in Zen, everything is Buddha. Everything is teaching. Every single person we encounter in our lives, whether it's at work, at the supermarket, the hardware store, in traffic, every person is teaching. Can we hear it? Can we see it? We now come to section 2 of this collection, and the title is Tripitaka Dharma Teacher Bodhidharma, Wei period. Wei was the name of the kingdom, a at the time of Bodhidharma's life. Everyone will by now have seen the painting of Bodhidharma that we hung in this end of the East Hall. That's near the water table. There's a niche part of the wall that's set in, and we've had other things there in the past, and this time we found this painting of Bodhidharma sitting in his cave facing the wall. Perfect subject for sesshin, for a retreat center. And this begins, it was meditation master Bodhidharma who took it up after Gunabhadra Tripitaka. The word Tripitaka means the three baskets, literally. And these refer to the three components or elements of the Buddhist canon. The Vinaya, which are the monastic rules and regulations. The sutras, the purported words of the Buddha and later some others, and the Abhidharma, which is the collection, vast collection of Buddhist psychology and philosophy and commentaries, shastras, commentaries on the sutras. Intent on clarifying the great vehicle, he traveled by sea to Wu Ye, which is southeast China, the coast of southeast China, and then traveled north to Ye, the capital of the Wei dynasty. It goes on, I'm skipping here a little bit. The Dharma teacher Bodhidharma was a man of southern India, the third son of a local monarch. His intellect was very incisive and clear, and he clearly understood what he was taught. His will was set on the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. He perpetuated the seed of the sages and made it flourish. With deepest mind empty and still, he saw through and comprehended the things and events of the world. I love the style of this text. You can just imagine the first translator sitting in the light of an oil lamp and with this ancient scroll that was found in the Dungwan caves and copying it, translating it, these characters, ideographs from 1,000 years earlier, 1,500 years earlier. The tone of this text seems to be one of great age and simplicity. But to go on, inner and outer, he was clear about it all. His virtue went beyond the world. His compassion and concern reached every corner of the land. The correct teaching was in decline, so he came from afar across mountains and seas, traveling to teach in the lands of China. those who cultivated mind emptied, still silence, those who cultivated or practiced, it means cultivated always means practice, those who practice mind emptied, still silence, all believed in him. The type who cling to forms and fixate on opinions began to slander and denounce him. One of the many legends that have accrued to Bodhidharma are that he was poisoned by a jealous monk. It's all this phrase, his intellect was very incisive and clear. It's all the more fascinating then that with such an intellect that he distinguished himself by sitting unmoving, facing a wall in the cave. We could say that his intellect was incisive and clear enough to have seen through, seen the limitations of the intellect. His will was set on the great vehicle, the Mahayana. It goes on, during this time he only had the two monks Dao Yu and Hui Ke with him. Though they were younger, they brought with them wills that were lofty and far-reaching. Being fortunate enough to meet with the Dharma teacher, they served him many years, respectfully seeking instruction. They learned well, encountering the teacher's intent. Moved by their fine energy and sincerity, the Dharma teacher instructed them in the true path. He taught them how to pacify mind, how to develop practice, how to accord with beings, and how to employ skill in means. These are four big accomplishments. How to pacify mind, that is, how to pacify really means to allow the mind to settle utterly, totally, fall silent. How to develop practice, how to accord with beings, how to live in harmony with all living beings, and how to employ skill in means. This, in a way, is certainly with teaching, this is what it all comes down to, skill in means. To have the insight, to have the wisdom, to have which means to have realized wisdom, is one thing, but then it's a matter of how one applies it to students, how one applies it in any given situation. Sometimes there's a simile used for these two aspects of teaching. One is, it's like two wings of a bird. There's the wisdom aspect, and then there's the skillful means aspect. And our bird can't fly unless it has both. Wisdom, you could say, is static. It's just what it is. It's something that is common to all of us, this wisdom. But it must manifest, it must be applied, that wisdom. And that's what is so infinitely challenging. And he elaborates now on those four things. This is the great vehicle teaching for pacifying mind. Let there be no error. Those who pacify mind like this do wall gazing. Those who develop practice like this do the four practices. We'll get to that in a minute. Those who accord with beings like this prevent slander and dislike. And those who have skill and means like this dispense with what does not apply. Here I abbreviate what is to be followed. The message is in the text below. Just before we get to those four practices, this where he says, those who accord with beings like this prevent slander and dislike. My mind, when I read this sentence, my mind goes to the sixth and seventh precepts. I resolve not to speak of the faults of others, but to be understanding and sympathetic. I resolve not to praise myself and disparage others, but to overcome my own shortcomings. These two are arguably the two precepts that give the greatest number of people trouble. And then these four practices, this is a text that we've read from in the past. I won't read the full body of it, but just to mention what they are. These are first the practice of repaying wrongs, second the practice of going along with the causal nexus, third the practice of not seeking anything, and fourth the practice of according with the Dharma. Repaying, just briefly, the first one, repaying wrongs, that's when suffering, that we reflect on the fact that this is karmic retribution, that we ourselves are the architects of this suffering. This is just the effect of which we ourselves were the cause. The going along with the causal nexus is not making the mistake of seeing either fortune or misfortune as permanent. Things happen, and as they're happening, once they've happened, whether it's winning the lottery or having our house destroyed in a hurricane, either one is to be understood as just causes and conditions that will change. The practice of not seeking anything, this is self-evident, not grasping. Even in terms of merit, grasping and doing things in order to get merit, certainly not grasping at enlightenment. Really means the thought of enlightenment. And then the practice of according with the Dharma. This is realizing for oneself the emptiness of all things. And he says, if the wise can believe and understand with certainty this inner truth, that is the truth of no self, no thingness, shunyata, they ought to practice in accord with the Dharma. And this, he elaborates, are the practicing in accordance with the six paramitas, the six perfections of giving, morality, effort, patience, meditation, and wisdom. That's the end of the Bodhidharma section, and next comes Bodhidharma's successor, Hui Ke. Hui Ke is the guy who approached Bodhidharma in desperation, begging for his teaching, and Bodhidharma could see that he still had he still was contaminated in his mind by his arrogance, and so he rejected him. He said, "How can someone like you understand this great Dharma?" Of course, he was testing him. And then Hui Ke, according to the legend, he cut off his arm, stayed out in the snow all night long, and when Bodhidharma saw this compelling evidence of his sincerity, then he accepted him as a student and later made him his successor. But let's read now from the text. The one who took it up after the Chan master Bodhidharma was the Chan master Hui Ke. At the age of 14, he met Bodhidharma, who was traveling and teaching in the region. Hui Ke served him for 6 years, investigating the one vehicle with pure energy and drawing near to the abstruse inner truth. And then we have here, it says, of all the enlightened ones of the 10 directions, past and present, there is not one who became Buddha, enlightened, without a basis in sitting meditation. And then a sutra called the Ten Stages Sutra. Within the bodies of sentient beings, there is an indestructible enlightened nature. It is like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright, round, and full. Its light, vast and boundless. Because it is covered over by the layered clouds of the five skandhas, sentient beings do not see it. If you encounter the wind of wisdom, it blows away the five skandhas. When the layers of clouds are totally gone, the enlightened nature is shining perfectly bright, clear, and pure. These five skandhas we mention every time we chant the Prajnaparamita. They're variously translated as form, feeling, thought, choice, and consciousness. Feeling is sometimes translated as sensation. Thought is translated as perception. Choice It's often translated as volition, our will, our impulses, our mental formations. And consciousness, we mentioned yesterday, of the eight layers of consciousness, our modes of consciousness. So all this activity of mind, this process that makes us sentient beings, this also obscures the sun of our true nature. The Huayan Sutra says, it is as vast as the universe, as ultimate as the void. But it is also like a light in a jar that cannot illuminate the outside. Another simile is this: when clouds close in on all sides and the world is darkened, how can the sunlight be bright and clear? But the sunlight has not been destroyed. It is just covered over and blocked off by the clouds. The pure reality nature of sentient beings is also like this. It cannot become fully manifest precisely because layers upon layers of clouds, afflictions, the perceptions of false thoughts clinging to objects, cover over and block off the path of the sages. If false thoughts are not born and you sit in silent purity, the sun of great nirvana is spontaneously bright and clear. A worldly book says, ice is born from water, but ice can block water. Ice is solid, whereas water flows. This is probably where what Hakuin drew from in his Zazen Wasan, the chant we do at the beginning of Taisho, where he says, like water and ice, without water no ice, outside us no Buddhas. But back to our text, similarly, falsity arises from the real, and falsity can lose the real in delusion. When falsity is ended, the real appears. The mind see is clear and pure. The body of reality is empty and clean. So this statement, falsity arises from the real and falsity can lose the real in delusion. So delusion itself ultimately is not apart from, not outside this true nature. And yet, delusion blocks our seeing this true nature, even though it is another aspect of true mind. This is why it is so foolish to despise our ego. There's nothing there. There's no ego of any substance. This is the real danger of even talking about, even referring to ego, is in doing so, we make it into a thing. And it's not a thing. There is nothing there. There is no I. There's no entity. There's no Satan. The ego is just a cluster, an amalgam of thoughts and memories and associations and images, self-images. It's just the conditioning of the mind that is congealed and to form what appears to be a self, but it is without substance. He goes on, if you completely comprehend the clear purity of the mind source, then all vows are fulfilled, all practices are completed, all is accomplished. You are no longer subject to states of being. For those who find this body of reality, the numberless sentient beings are just one good person. The one person who has been there in accord with this through a million billion eons. One good person. Linchi, Rinzai, was referring to this one good person when he said this man of no rank, beyond rank. The Buddha was referring to this one good person when he said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world honored one. No other. Only this one. He goes on, if pure energy and true integrity are not generated within you, it accomplishes nothing, even if you encounter countless Buddhas, past, present, and future. Or we could say enlightened ones. Thus we know that sentient beings liberate themselves by knowing mind. The Buddhas do not liberate the sentient beings. If the Buddhas could liberate sentient beings, since we have met countless Buddhas in the past, why haven't we become enlightened? It is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. Unless the mind attains what the mouth speaks of, you will never avoid taking on form according to your deeds. Or we could say you will never avoid creating karma. So again, he says, it is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. Well, our nature is pure energy. That is our nature. There's nowhere we have to get it. But we need to liberate it. We need to mobilize this energy. And we do that through Zazen. This pure energy gets impeded, it gets tied up, it gets tangled up in our thoughts. It is our thoughts that break the flow of this pure energy. So it is by refraining from pursuing thoughts or clinging to thoughts that we release this pure energy. Everyone knows how this works as we do intense Zazen for days at a time. We feel this energy, energy flow more and more. It's because it has been liberated from the fetters of thought, the shackles of our thinking. He goes on, thus, enlightened nature is like sun and moon to the world. Within wood there is the potential for fire. within humans there is an enlightened true identity. It is also called the lamp of Buddha nature and the mirror of nirvana. The great nirvana mirror is brighter than sun and moon. Inside and out, it is perfectly pure, boundless, and infinite. Within wood, there is the potential for fire. Within humans, there is an enlightened true identity that we simply need to ignite through penetrating Zazen. The fire is there. Call it energy, call it fire. It is something that everyone is equally endowed with. It's not something that someone has more than, some have more than others. This is our nature, this fire. Can we find it? Can we ignite it? Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.